NE, I guess Deputy Secretary, I think that's his title. What is it?
NE is DOE Nuclear Energy.
Right. Stand corrected. Anyway, that is, he came out with this strategy, probably will not go forward without any congressional authorization or appropriations that DOE have set. The proposed consent-based siting process would be governed by legally binding agreements between the federal government and host jurisdictions. That's kind of a quote out of the study. I think they mean by host jurisdictions, they basically mean host communities. The strategy states that the involvement of multiple communities may also be part of this strategy moving forward. Why did we even consider it? If you look at our area and our region, the broad context of the region, the Carolinas and Georgia represent much of the focus of the nuclear renaissance, as Steve just started off the talk today. Development of new technology, especially in the nuclear realm, will be focused a lot in this area. We will be looked at whether we would like to be looked at or not. So that's why we started off, if we're going to be looked at, let's start talking and start the dialogue. We started community discussions probably about 10 months ago with two simple questions with a working group that we had to begin the process. And our questions were, should a five-county region surrounding the Savannah River site use its assets to help provide solutions to manage the nation's fuel cycle? And if so, what are the terms and conditions under which the community would agree to participate? We determined that we needed more information besides our local group to provide the local community and leaders with information about resources and issues related to managing the back end of the fuel cycle. One thing the working group did say or kind of agreed upon was they were really not considered in only hosting a storage facility. Basically, they all agreed that no storage without value added to the region was not a direction they would want to head. When we say hosting only or having only a storage or consolidated facility, we mean just hosting a pad similar to the Hardin storage facilities. We don't think that's what we would want in our community. We believe we need to look at other types of aspects associated with that. Consolidated storage by itself brings limited economic benefits, as you heard earlier, and is construed by many as a potential negative impact factor for the overall region. Therefore, any community role must include job-creating activities, including research and development. You may hear that several times. Research and development is one of the key aspects to start off initially, and manufacturing associated with managing the nuclear fuel cycle. And we agree with the DOE that it must include legally binding commitments to a final disposition plan and provide opportunities for ultimate disposal of nuclear materials currently already stored at Savannah Riverside. Through our organization, Dick Stein Shapiro of Washington, D.C. was retained to help us with this research study. The lead on the effort was Tim Frazier, who's with us today in the audience. Prior to joining that firm, Tim led the Blue Ribbon Commission's America's Nuclear Future for the Department of Energy. Tim was the designated federal officer.
Correct.
I got one right. All right, community impacts, including impacts on economic development and public sentiment, are key elements of consideration and will be an area of the focus of the study. It's important to note that this is only a study. Again, it's just a study to inform and provide needed information. No decisions have been made to pursue anything. It's not a decision document. The study results were actually publicly released yesterday. The scope of the work for the study included technical considerations related to fuel storage, research and development, manufacturing, training, and the need for potential reprocessing. The study also looked at community support and consensus. state and local government support, economic opportunities and potential risk, incentives and conditions, and needed legislative actions to make all this happen. The study reached basically five key conclusions. The first is that community understanding and support are vital to solving the protracted national problem of managing the back end of the nuclear fuel cycle. I'll emphasize protracted. It will take a long time. No one is talking about an immediate process happening overnight. Reminds me of the story of the turtle that got mugged by the two snails. And the arresting officer came up to the turtle and asked him what happened. And the turtle said, "Your officer, it happened so fast, it was a blur." So time is all dependent upon relativeness. So all of this will work itself out. It will take time, and the informed consent process will be protracted. Secondly, community involvement should objectively explore issues, address risks, both real and perceived, and rely on factual information that is trustworthy. The third conclusion was that the community needs to fully evaluate and understand any potential for new skilled jobs and incremental economic impacts that can accompany fuel cycle activities. Fourth, the region has many assets can be marshaled to facilitate a national solution. And I think that's an important context too, is a solution. We're not looking at just continual storage. The nation needs a solution to our whole nuclear fuel cycle. These activities or assets we have include the H Canyon, which is unique in the nation, possibly the world, and what its capabilities are. And the final conclusion, if the local community determines the risk-reward ratio is acceptable, appropriate state and federal entities and the public at large must understand the basis for any community consensus on this issue. And I think you need to go back and look at the definition of consent base or consensus will not be 100%. There will be some folks who do not approve of whatever happens through the process. And this is a good slide. I like it, and it gives the elements of a good consent-based siting process. It should be prescriptively defined, but permitted to develop organically among interested parties. Regardless of the specific process for developing consent, success will be measured by an agreement among the interested parties that is legally enforceable. During the process, the parties involved must negotiate in good faith and be open to creative solutions to address the issues that arise, including oversight from possibly DHEC or other regulatory agencies, incentives and compensation. Congress and the new management entity, or DOE if that's the case, must be willing to let communities and states reach their own conclusions about whether or not it is a burden to host a new facility and to let them identify the framework and restrictions under which they wish to operate. To find the sweet spot, if you will, in the Venn diagram there on the slide, the spot to success, if you will. However, reliance on funding from DOE to accomplish these activities cannot be waited on. Private funding must also be pursued. So in the study, we're not talking about all of this being funded or any of managing the back hill solely on the government. There have to be some private partners step forward as well. Our board of directors from the CRO will consider in the next steps what its role is helping to define a comprehensive plan aimed at building a community consensus about hosting fuel cycle related facilities. As noted earlier, at this time, no decisions have been made. We're in an exploratory phase only at this time. Again, Dr. Makhachani said the informed consent base. This is beginning the dialogue. Because of the CRO's broad regional mission, our organization's role is one of facilitator, as we see it, to provide the information and education and a platform for public discussion as interested citizens and groups work together to arrive at a community consensus. We will be part of a strategy for communicating our common position on hosting or potentially hosting nuclear fuel cycle facilities to key decision makers. Our study that we mentioned rolling out yesterday is available on our website. It's basically srscro.org. It's under our community issues tab, and both the executive summary and the full report is available there. I think that's it.
And council members, you have the executive summary. That's printed out for you. Questions?
Yes. Oh, thanks very much. Having been around this business a long time, you talked about terms like legally binding. So was to take custody of fuel in 1998 legally binding. And so I think if you're talking about people here that are going to have any fuel come in here and maybe just do some work on it and reprocess it, but get it out of here, you might be able to do something. But if you're going to talk about stacking it up or storing it or permanently storing it, I think you got a practically an impossible task.
And we agree. That's what we our stories. That's why the whole study says that. We need to look at the whole process, not just one aspect of it, such as storage. You also, the legal binding process of it fits into this other quasi-government agency, FedCorp. Currently, DOE, but is not well trusted on some of their previous commitments they have made in the state. So that's why we're saying it really has to be either a public-private or a lot of this has to be under private domain that you can actually pursue a legal binding commitment. That's why the FedCorp or the GovCorp is the way we think the process needs to move forward. You can legally bind TVA to something. Their budget is not set up on an annual basis, or at least they have the process to be able to be signed into agreements. That's not necessarily the case with the government.
The government still has to back up anything that's legally found. It's still taxpayer money.
Well, the taxpayers already backed that with the Nuclear Waste Policy Act with the funding aspect of it. We've put in, last count I had, $1.2 billion, Steve, in taxpayer dollars out of the state of South Carolina alone, close to $600 to $800 million from the state of Georgia has gone into the Nuclear Waste Fund. And that is to remove the spent nuclear fuel from the existing facilities to a repository. So, and it generates $750 million a year. So there is money sitting out there to move this process forward. It's just not within the government's purview to, or interest to get that move forward.
Rick, on one of the slides, you said that you're not interested in hosting only a storage facility. What exactly do you mean by that? Because if I look at what the Blue River Commission at a high level recommended, it is host-only type of facilities until we get our act together, which is a big ask, and figure out where to put the fuel.
What we mean is you have to have research and development come with that, non-destructive analysis, manufacturing a cast for transportation. We're not interested in just a storage pad to bring waste in that has no method or disposition path out of the state.
Okay.
Does that clear? There's nuances with that, and it needs to be broadly defined on what this consolidated storage has, or the interim storage, or the pilot storage.
Okay.
We wouldn't be satisfied with just a concrete pad.
All right. Anybody from your organization or the person that generated the report visit Sweden, because they've had consolidated interim storage for a long period of time before they made their decision to store it under the Baltic?
I'll let Tim talk that. He has, as a matter of fact, one of his favorite slides is one from Sweden.
Yeah. As part of the Blue Ribbon Commission, when I ran the commission, we visited Sweden and Finland. Do you want me to come up to the mic?
Mm-hmm. We can get it on the recordings better that way.
Yeah, we visited Sweden, Finland, as well as France and the UK. Primarily in France, we went to the Bur region. In Finland, we went down to Erioki, which is in the southern part of Finland, where they're going to establish their repository. And then we went to Oskarshamn in Sweden. And I got to tell you, from the commissioner's perspective, my commissioners for the Blue Ribbon Commission that were on that trip, it was very telling to see a process, work typically as envisioned. I think the Swedes had a couple of starts and stops, but they really were able to, in the end, have two competing municipalities, they call it, which is much larger than a state, or much larger than a county, but smaller than a state. One was at Forsmark, which is in the southern part, and Oskarshamn, which is in the northern. And the slide that Rick's talking about is a slide of the day the winner was announced. And there's a guy that's kind of very glum looking and unhappy, and then there's another guy standing beside him that has this big grin on his face. And the guy that won the competition, obviously, was the guy with the big grin on his face, because they had worked very diligently to try to do it. So from the commission's perspective, I won't say it's a model, because it doesn't exactly work in the United States, because there's, between the municipalities and the federal government in Sweden, there's nothing. Between the communities here and the federal government, there's a state, which incidentally is the big problem in Nevada. You know, the Nye County, which is a state, which is the county that Yucca Mountain is in, is violently supportive of Yucca Mountain and would love to have it established tomorrow. But the state and Senator Reid, et cetera. But yes, we did go to Sweden. We highlighted it in the commission's report, if you care to look at it.
Tim, can you state your name, please?
Oh, sorry, Tim Frazier.
Who was the
I was
DFO
the
for?
Designated federal officer for the Blue Ribbon Commission, former senior technical advisor to the Assistant Secretary for Nuclear Energy.
And the senior author on this study.
Yeah, and the senior author on
gotcha.
This study.
Gotcha, thank you.
Ooh, can I make one correction?
Mm-hmm.
Arjun had in his slide that the Blue Ribbon Commission didn't endorse or we knocked down reprocessing. Actually, the language in the report is very specific and was very carefully worded. It says that the commission thought it was premature to pick a policy on closing the nuclear fuel cycle. And it was written that way because there were as many commissioners for reprocessing and as many commissioners against reprocessing in my Blue Ribbon Commission, which had 15. So to say that the Blue Ribbon Commission came out against reprocessing is not correct. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Any other questions?
Just one observation as you make this pitch around the state and perhaps other places. You do talk about risk, but the concept of safety never really comes out.
We can definitely include that. I guess we get so used to the site being so safe, it's not an issue that we think we need to highlight, but we can definitely add that to our criteria. That's one thing that, while I was talking about the site, too, is that folks have to keep in mind when we're talking about this regional approach, there's no set cast in stone that it has to be within the 310 square miles of Savannah Riverside. So a lot of folks make that connection or jump to that conclusion, and no one is saying that. But the region, the broad region we're in the southeast, this could be applicable to several areas, not just on Savannah Riverside. It could be outside the fence, or it could be other areas within that southeast region.
I'd like to applaud your comments and ideas, and I'd like to make a statement that I would hope that before any consolidation would occur, there would be much more public discussion than there was in the situation when the plutonium was consolidated in South Carolina, which occurred, and then we were informed that it had happened. And now, of course, this is a completely different situation because we're dealing with public utilities with the majority of this material, but I would hope that there'd be much more public discussion and public approval of that situation.
Totally agree. Thank you.
We're going to take a 10-minute break, so it's 2:20-something. Anyway, 10 minutes on your watches to be back. Thanks. Take your seats, please. We'll keep going. If you want to make a public comment and you haven't signed up, go ahead and sign up on the sheet outside. I'll ask for other people, but it's easier for me to go down to recognize you. And before I start the SRS component of this, I got ahead of myself. Shelly Wilson usually does the DHEC update. She is not here today, but she sent me her talking points, so I'll just go over them real quickly. Statute regulation and policy review. Recently, Governor Haley established a regulatory review task force to evaluate South Carolina's current regulatory burdens on businesses and to propose recommendations to relieve those burdens. As part of this review, the task force will evaluate reports submitted by agencies that identify current and proposed statutes, rules, regulations, and policies that are a burden on South Carolina's economy. DHEC fully supports this initiative by Governor Haley and invites the public, including businesses, employees, professional associations, conservation organizations, and any other affected person or entity, to comment on the statutes and regulations implemented by DHEC that may unduly burden businesses or employees. Comments on proposed statutes and regulations are welcome. In addition to receiving written comments, DHEC will host 4 public hearings to receive all comments for consideration in preparing DHEC's report. So here's the important part. For specific information on how to submit comments as well as public hearing dates and locations, go to their website, which is www.scdhec.gov/administration/regulations-policies.htm. And I'll just leave this up here so you guys can get it if you need it. DHEC has also developed a new permitting-related customer service tool for citizens and businesses on a website called DHEC Permit Central. Citizens and businesses will be able to find out which permits they may need, who to contact, and how long it might take. Customers can also track the status of an application submitted and find out more information for some of the most common permitting processes. So the DHEC expects to publicly launch the site next week. Public notice for SRS tanks 5 and 6, and I'm sure Dave will talk about this a little bit. DOE has requested approval from DHEC of the industrial wastewater closure module for waste tanks 5F and 6F to support removal from service of these subject tanks located in the F area tank farm at the SRS. The F Tank Farm General Closure Plan, approved January 24, 2011, establishes the protocols by which DOE would, 1, close SRS F Tank Farm waste systems in accordance with South Carolina Regulations R.61-82, proper closeout of wastewater treatment facilities, and R.6167, standards for wastewater facility construction and other programs, and 2, obtain approval from DHEC for subsequent tank system-specific closure modules. So the subject tanks 5F and 6F closure model is available for public review and comment. It describes the processes by which DOE removed waste from tanks 5 and 6, sampled residual contaminants, characterized remaining residual inventory, and isolated the tanks from the F tank farm facilities that remain operable. A 30-day public comment period for review of the subject tank 5F and 6F closure module began the February 20th and will conclude March the 22nd. So I said it was the end of March, but it's really March the 22nd. To provide public comment, please do so in writing by March the 22nd, 2013. Comments will be considered in DHEC's final decision. Send your comments to Bridget Clark, scdhec/water, 2600 Bull Street, Columbia, 29201, or by email at Clark, C-L-A-R-K-E-B-M, at dhec.sc.gov. So if Shelley was here, that is what she would have told you. Thank you. Okay, our next speaker, Dave, is going to do the SRS all by himself today. Dave.
I have, you have your backup. My backup is here. I know there's interest, and I'm here to tell you we fell off the cliff and there are rocks at the bottom of the cliff. It is a very difficult budget situation. Sequestration reduced our funding by $100 million, about 8%, at the Savannah River site. And unfortunately, it does not give us the flexibility to move those funds around within the budget categories. And so, with no flexibility, there's very little we can do to mitigate the impact of those cuts.
So we have already issued a formal request for reprogramming to headquarters. We are trying to be first in line. We certainly would and have requested a restoration of the $100 million. In the absence of that, we are requesting give us the opportunity to make the decisions on where the cuts go, and we will deobligate funds from certain projects. We will prioritize and defer some projects, and we will concentrate on protecting our greatest resource, which is our people. So what are some of the impacts of a $1.2 billion budget instead of $1.3? We are looking at reduced work week, 32 hours instead of 40 for a couple of thousand employees at the site. Several hundred employees will have several month furloughs later on in the summer. Without any flexibility to move funds around, H Canyon will go into limited operation. We will cease processing used fuel. We will not be able to exercise the agreement on bringing in enriched uranium solutions, nor will we be able to continue to process and purify plutonium for MOX. And we'll have limited capability to receive research reactor fuel. There certainly won't be any overtime, and we will have to dictate windows of opportunity for bringing in materials. Risk reduction in 235F will be impacted as well, which is an old plutonium 238 processing facility. Later on, if there is no relief, no ability to move funds around, then K&L areas along with H would go to minimal operation status. And we would not be able to continue shipments to WIP. We currently have characterized almost all of the legacy transuranic waste at the site. It is ready for shipping, but under this budget scenario, we would have to curtail those shipments. Salt waste processing is another question that often comes before this group. We're about 65% complete with construction, and we are continuing to negotiate with Parsons on the overrun and developing a baseline for path forward for salt waste processing. We continue to generate high-level waste glass canisters. Record year last year with 277 canisters generated. As we see the delays in salt waste processing, we are looking at what at-tank technologies we can use to augment our current capacity. We will go into an outage with our current pilot facility, the ARA-PMCU, this summer and change to a next generation solvent, which we believe will allow us to move up from 1.5 million gallons a year to approaching 3.5 to 4 million gallons a year of high-level waste processed through that pilot facility. We've already upgraded for extended year operation, and that is being done so that we can mitigate some of the delays with salt waste processing. We're also moving forward and looking for the funds to deploy at tank processing, which is essential to Hanford operations in the future and would be advantageous to us because we could add another 3 million gallons potentially to our processing capability with the addition of at tank processing. We have had extraordinary success in closing tanks at the Savannah River site with the celebration of grouting, closing and grouting tanks 18 and 19. We are on track to close 5 and 6. We are in the NRC consultation phase with the H tank farm. And we